This is episode number 14 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, May 24th, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Up for discussion this week, Dennis Kucinich wants to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. Tim Wu wants to attach Carterphone-style regulations to the winners of next year's spectrum auction. And Nicholas Negroponte, head of the One Laptop Per Child program, wants to be the only one distributing cheap laptops to third world children. Joining me to discuss these topics is Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Jerry.
James Catusa of the Heritage Foundation. Hey, James.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. And our guest this week is Joe Wiesenthal, an analyst at TechDirt. Hey, Joe.
How's it going?
Good. Okay, so up first, we're going to talk about Dennis Kucinich and the Fairness Doctrine. So, James, what's this all about?
Well, actually, the Fairness Doctrine, as a start, remember, anything that the government proposes or proposed in government that has the word fairness in it should be treated with suspicion.
Right.
The Fairness Doctrine being the leading example of that. The doctrine itself is a rule that was formed by the Federal Communications Commission back in the 40s when you had, like, maybe two or three AM radio stations per city, and perhaps one television station, and it was a rule that meant to ensure this full and fair debate of the issues. And as probably could be predicted, it had the opposite effect. It discouraged any station managers, any broadcasters, from actually discussing issues of importance, because if they touched one controversial issue and didn't do it absolutely perfectly in a way that pleased everyone, they would get sued. So how did
the Fairness Doctrine work? Basically, if a station talked about, immigration and presented a side, if one side felt that it wasn't represented, it could demand airtime? Is that how it worked?
It would demand airtime, and most frequently it would be something that would come up at license renewal time or in a complaint to the FCC for general, what they might call bias or unbalance over a period of time. So not so much one particular episode, one particular program, but programming over a period of time. The problem with it is it was extremely difficult to define in advance what was fair and what wasn't fair, what a contrasting view is, how many views you had to show. So as a result, programming on the radio and television, until this rule was repealed in the late 80s, was sort of like cottage cheese. It was bland. It filled the plate, but nothing spicy or controversial at all.
It's because anytime anybody said anything like that, they would have to provide equal time, and what would happen is that nobody would say anything interesting to avoid that.
That's right, and I don't know if anyone here remembers an editorial on a typical television station was like in the late 80s, but you might have the station manager getting up there and saying, I believe that we should have improvements in public education and congratulate our teachers for doing a good job and working so hard. And then they'd have another saying, if anyone has a contrasting or conflicting view, you are welcome to come on and give a rebuttal.
And so it wasn't until this was repealed that folks like Rush Limbaugh or some of these other folks were able to go on the air.
Exactly. The number of radio stations, for instance, with a talk radio format has tripled since 1990, and that doesn't include the increases from 87 when the rule itself was repealed. Rarely has a repeal of a government regulation had such an almost immediate and tangible result.
All right, so who wants to bring this back and why?
Well, at the beginning of this year, Dennis Kucinich, as you mentioned, announced that he was going to pursue a reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine. Now, Kucinich, you may know, is, you might say, not in the complete mainstream of even the Democratic Party. He's running for president. The odds are against him winning. So given that, it wasn't clear how seriously to take his commitment to restore the Fairness Doctrine. But what happened last week was there were reports that Nancy Pelosi and other members of the Democratic leadership in the House have now adopted this as an agenda item. Reportedly, quote, will aggressively pursue reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine. That changes the game. That if the Democratic leadership is in fact pursuing this, it makes it a real danger.
So
this,
Are we talking about exactly the same fairness doctrine, or are they talking about changing it somehow to avoid some of the worst aspects of the original fairness doctrine?
Well, I haven't seen anything that would vary from the language that was in place before. Now, they don't have the bill out there yet. I think there's some that have been introduced, but really there's nothing from the leadership and nothing that would tell us what direction they'll go in. Although what's really disturbing is the worst aspects of the fairness doctrine going beyond the general chilling effect was when it was used to chill specific types of speech, when it was aimed at a particular political opponent. And that seems to be driving the push this year. So many of the proponents, including in this one report in the American Spectator, an aide to Nancy Pelosi herself, ties in the restoration of the fairness doctrine to the need to quiet down Rush Limbaugh and to combat his perceived dominance on AM radio. With that kind of talk, that is itself the worst aspect of the fairness doctrine. Politicians using this rule to quiet specific political opponents. So it doesn't seem reassuring at all there.
So would this withstand First Amendment scrutiny, do you think?
I'm tempted to hope that this will actually pass through Congress, be enacted by Congress, so that we can get a Supreme Court decision on this. In 1969, in a case called Red Lion Broadcasting versus FCC, the Fairness Doctrine was upheld as constitutional on the grounds that radio spectrum is scarce. Now that's a laughable proposition today. Not only do you have many more radio and television stations than you had in 1969, but you have cable, you have satellite radio, and you have things like what we're doing right now, the Internet. That makes the notion of scarcity just unimaginable. So I'm tempted to say, hey, bring it on. Let's enact this and get a terrific Supreme Court decision knocking it down. But then again, you never know what the Supreme Court will do. If this were by some permutation or a logical dance up to all this constitutional, we could see a real chilling of political debate in this country.
And it would be an act of Congress, not just a rule by the FCC. So it'd be
would be an act of Congress. That's right. One interesting side note to this is that although this rule is in place for some 40 years, it was never adopted by Congress, and there was never anything specifically in the FCC's authorizing statute that allowed them to do this. It was purely under their general authority to enforce the public interest on the airwaves.
In fact, the Communications Act specifically says that the FCC shall not censor.
In addition to the Constitution saying.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. We got Tim Wu, who wants to attach Carter phone-style regulations to the winners of next year's Spectrum auction. And, of course, since we know Spectrum isn't scarce, why does he want to do this, Tim?
Well, so something you'll probably be hearing a lot about in the tech blogosphere over the next year, the digital TV transition is winding down, which means that in 2009 we'll have a block of spectrum that's currently being used for analog television that will be available for new uses. And so the FCC next year is going to hold an auction to decide who gets to make use of that spectrum.
And this isn't just any spectrum. This is prime
this is
spectrum.
Prime
it goes
spectrum.
Walls.
Right, exactly. This is probably the best spectrum that's going to become available in the foreseeable future. It'll allow, you'll go through walls and foliage, and you can get fairly high bandwidth over it. And so so the people like Tim Wu are right that this is a golden opportunity to make sure we have a vibrant broadband marketplace. And so what he wants to do is he wants to place some what he calls Carter phone conditions on the spectrum, saying basically that whoever wins the auction has to allow any device to be attached to the network.
So now, Tim, why is it called Carter phone? What's Carter phone?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Carter phone, it was a decision in the 1960s about whether AT&T could restrict what devices could be attached to the old telephone network back when AT&T was a monopoly. I believe it was an FCC ruling. And that ruling held that that AT&T had to allow any device that wouldn't damage the network.
So if I had a fax machine and I wanted to attach it to just my phone line before Carter phone, AT&T could tell me, no, you can't attach anything but our black telephone.
That's right. Phone, fax machine, modems, all those things would not have been possible, or at least would have taken longer to develop because we would have had to wait for AT&T themselves.
So Carter phone is a good thing, though, right?
Well, in the context of the 1960s, when you had a regulated monopoly running the telephone system and you had a fairly simple network, yeah, I think it was a good decision because it did open up what was previously a monopoly marketplace to some new competition, at least in the device segment. There's two problems here. One, obviously, is that it's not a monopoly. You already have four carriers, which Wu calls them oligopolies, but you know, four is a lot more than one. The market is evolving very quickly. You're seeing you know, prices have kind of gone pretty steadily. And then once this new wireless auction takes place, we can expect you know, additional people to enter the market, or at least we can hope so. So that's one problem with it, is that it's not analogous in that the current wireless marketplace is not a monopoly the way AT&T was. The other problem I see with it is that this is a network that's changing much more rapidly and that has a lot more diversity than the AT&T network. With the AT&T system, you had basically just one standard. You had the standard plug, phone plug that you plug into the wall, and you know, electrically it was very simple, and so it wasn't that hard for the FCC to come up with a series of rules to determine what is and isn't allowed, and you know, sort of what AT&T was and wasn't allowed to do. With a wireless network, there are lots of different standards out there that they could use that support lots of different ways of using the network. And it's not at all clear if you institute, I mean, it's not clear what the Carter phone rule would be, because it's not clear what things AT&T has to enable or not enable. It's already true for, I believe, AT&T and T-Mobile's networks. It's already true you've got the little SIM card that stores the basic subscriber information. You can already take that out and put it in another phone, and sometimes you have to do some hardware hacking, but it's entirely legal to do so, and you can attach any phone you want to it. So in some sense, we already have a Carter phone rule. What it doesn't support is all sorts of other devices that want to use the network in other ways, but that's not so much a matter of attaching devices as it is as a matter of changing the way the network works to support those devices.
Is this an issue where Tim Wu has to, I mean, overstate the problem to make his case? Where, you know, there's no reason for us to implement a wireless Carter phone rule unless you can first convince people that there's some big problem, that, you know, we're stuck with these walled gardens that we can't get out of.
Well, I certainly think that there is some, you know, benefit to highlighting, you know, that the market is not perfect, and it certainly would be nice if there was... If it was easier for entrepreneurial firms to get access to these wireless networks. But one of the things I was a little bit disappointed about is in his paper that he released earlier this year that sort of laid out the case, one of the first things he said was that regulation should be a last resort. And, you know, that was like 3 months ago. It's not clear to me that you know, it doesn't seem like he's treating it as though it ought to be a last resort, and I think he's right. It should be a last resort. And given how quickly the market is changing, I suspect that if all the activists who are currently pressing for a new rule instead picked one of the phone companies and lobbied the phone company, tried to, you know, persuade them of the market benefits of having a more open network, you might be able to get them to adopt it, and then we don't have to have... I guess the other problem with this is that every time the FCC tries to force a network owner to, you know, implement some standard against their will, you get foot dragging, you get litigation, you get, you know, armies of lobbyists descending on the FCC, and it takes, I mean, what was it? It was 9 years between the Telecom Act and Brand X when the battle over DSL was finally over. So sometime in, like, you know, 2019, we'll finally have the rules settled and people can start using this wireless network. I think it would be much better if you could get one or more of these network owners to voluntarily allow other devices on their network, because it would happen a lot quicker and it would involve less rent-seeking for all involved.
It's just interesting. I'm thinking of the parallels between the Carter phone issue and the Fairness Doctrine issue, which on first glance seem completely different, but they're sort of like both stemmed in regulatory nostalgia. The Carter phone decision was a 1968 FCC decision made for a completely different telecommunications world, one where you had a ubiquitous monopoly, and not the world you have today. And very similar situation with the Fairness Doctrine, which was based on a confirmed as constitutional in 1969 decision by the Supreme Court, in a world where you had very, very few video and radio options. And again, completely different than what you have today. But in both cases, people are looking back to the late 1960s and saying, yes, that was the world that we liked. Let's go back to that.
Right.
Wow. Tim, I'm very much looking forward to getting my hands on my iPhone, which I'm sure is right now in pieces and in some warehouse in China. Mm-hmm. And one of the features that the iPhone has is something they call visual voicemail. And what that does is when you get your voicemail, so you have 10 voicemails, you don't have to listen to them in order mm-hmm. before you get to the one you want to listen to. You're presented with on the screen with a list of who called you. You press the name of the person who you want to listen to, and you listen to just that voicemail. And that's an application that is only possible because on the network side, not on the app, not on the phone side, but on the network side, they installed the application. Is this something that if we have a standards-based sort of approach that Tim Wu suggests, would that hamper the ability of networks to install their own proprietary applications?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, that is an excellent example because the Carter phone network didn't have a lot of very complex interactions between the device and the network in the way that does. And it's not
at
all clear.
You just plugged it in.
You just plugged it in. It was, it was just a twisted pair of twisted copper pair. It basically just sent sound in both directions. And so it's not at all clear whether, I mean, this is an excellent example, is the FCC going to have regulations that specifies some sort of interface that the networks have to make available to any device that wants to do by wireless or video voicemail. I mean, it's just not clear. I mean, one way you could interpret it is simply that the data network facilities have to be open, and if they want to layer voice, if the AT&T or whoever wants to layer voice and video features on top of that data capability, they're allowed to do that. But again, you're going to have every time AT&T rolls out some new network feature, there's going to be a regulatory battle over, well, does this have to be open? Is the FCC rules going to say exactly how it has to work and who has to have access? You know, who's going to decide what the price is going to be for that access? And so he has an article in Forbes this week arguing it. You're describing this as a simple rule, and I haven't seen anybody lay out the details of what the rule would actually look like, but I'm having a lot of trouble imagining that it will actually be a simple rule.
All right. Thanks, Tim. Well, we're going to talk next about Nicholas Trigger-Ponte from MIT, who's got this one laptop per child program, which I've seen the laptop prototype, and it looks really cool. But there's a problem here, Joe. What is it?
Yeah, apparently Trigger-Ponte went on was on 60 Minutes this past weekend. I didn't actually catch the show, but I read all the articles about it. And complained that Intel, which has a rival ultra-cheap PC, basically, is basically doing it just to undermine his program. So the charge, he has this $100 laptop, although it's not actually $100. It's actually $176 laptop, but that's not as catchy.
Now, Joe, hold on a second. Let's back up a minute. So what is this program? What is Nick Trigger-Ponte trying to do here?
He has a fairly noble, I would say, goal of wanting to get these ultra-cheap computers into the hands of children all around the world. And so he's, worked pretty hard over the last couple of years to figure out a way to build a really cheap computer.
And these are children in third world countries, right?
Yeah, primarily in developing countries. Emerging market. So, so he's, done a lot of impressive technical stuff and been talking to governments and, trying to make this happen. Meanwhile, the cost of computers is dropping all the time, and Intel, which is a for-profit, just a company trying to do business, has a pretty cheap computer itself that, is trying to market for the same purposes, and he doesn't like that. And he thinks Intel is just trying to undermine his program, apparently because his computers use AMD processors, and he thinks that's really got Intel's goat, and he accuses them of selling their computers at a loss. So, yeah, he's pretty upset. And I think the reaction has generally been that, it is sour grapes, that he's whining. And most people seem to think that, you know, if his main concern is getting computers to poor children out around the world, he shouldn't be concerned about, you know, having competition or the fact that
he should be happy about it.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's he proposing to do about this, or does he have a suggestion?
Well, I'm under the impression that he has a solution. I mean, I think he's trying to shame Intel, and he wants them to stop, and he does, you know, I think he'd prefer that these other governments who might, you know, sign contracts with Intel to buy their computers, you know, that they would just deal with his OLPC group.
So now, Negroponte's program is completely non-profit, so...
Yeah, and that's also, I find it a little funny that he would be upset with Intel for taking a loss on his computers, and he's not even trying to make a profit at all. I mean, you know, if he's not able to make a profit on it, why is he upset with Intel for not making a profit on theirs? Right. He's accusing them of selling it below cost.
And I'm curious about that, because that would be something at least interesting to know if they were in fact taking a loss. But imagine that they're not, that they just built a better machine than he did, and they can build it even cheaper, for profit.
Well, the other sort of thing that doesn't make any sense is that actually Intel's computer is more expensive than his. So the idea that they're selling this more expensive but still pretty cheap computer as a way of undermining his project, and it doesn't really make any sense.
I do find it kind of fascinating that you've got a laptop that in some senses is held up as a case study in the power of open source software, and the defining characteristic, I think, of open source software is its decentralization, that you have a lot of individual volunteers that are contributing in sort of a joint effort. And then you've got this OLPC program where you've got pretty much a monolithic program that would make Microsoft proud, where you've got this hierarchical organization that's going to make the perfect laptop, and then it's going to sell them in batches of a million to world governments. There just seems to be a little bit of cognitive dissonance there, that we're going to take open source software and we're going to use a very non-open source-ish business model to get them in the hands of poor children around the world. And
well,
yeah,
it definitely seems, I mean, you know, I don't really know what Negroponte's motivation is, but it definitely seems that he wants to be the one to bring this great thing to the world. I mean, it's not, you know, I suspect, in some sense, I believe he really cares about the issue and bringing technology to people, but he wants it to be him, or he wants it to be his group, and that's very important to him. Because
mm-hmm.
he doesn't, as you said, he doesn't seem to be interested in fostering any sort of broader and more sustainable market for cheap computers with lots of different companies doing the same thing.
Right, and I would think that would be the way to do it. It would be you build, you know, a $300 laptop. You subsidize a little bit, you get it in the hands of 1,000 kids, and then, you know, you see what you do with it, and you shave off costs gradually, and you sort of build it incrementally the same way your typical open source software project does. And it seems strange to me that instead of doing it that way, it's this Big Bang approach where they're going to develop the perfect laptop, and then, you know. And the other thing is, are they planning upgrades and revisions, or is this going to be the one laptop that everybody's going to use for the next 10 years?
That's a good question. I'm not totally sure what their roadmap is, but I think you have to wonder if, you know, how sort of the staying power of a nonprofit organization to keep, you know, innovating and to keep making improvements. I mean, you know, if this were something that was driven more by market forces, you would just sort of assume that there'd be steady upgrades over the years, but I don't think you could be so confident of that using the OLPC model.
All right.
What's interesting is what you're talking about is much the same philosophy of philanthropy that Bill Gates has been introducing in Africa, that instead of just providing a one-shot support for people in whatever area, then make that a continuing need for support to he's been pushing for the idea of making things self-sustainable and profitable so that you can continue so these things can continue on its own. So it's interesting that the Bill Gates philosophy is being ignored by Nicholas Knight or Negroponte.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we should get those two together.
they might know each other.
Well, that's going to have to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. I want to thank our guests, Tim Lee, James Cattuso, and Joe Wiesenthal. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. See you next time.